In the matter of Ridgefield Park Board of Education and Ridgefield Park Education Association, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Terry Wright on behalf of the Ridgefield Park Board of Education and the law firm of Cordia from Lincoln.
Good morning, Justices. Stephen R. Cohen of the law firm of Selikoff and Cohen on behalf of the Ridgefield Park Education Association.
Ira W. Mintz from Weissman and Mintz on behalf of Amicus Communications Workers of America, AFL-CIO.
Welcome, Counsel. Ms. Wright.
Thank you, Chief Justice Ravner. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if necessary. Thank you. As set forth by this court, the question before the court is whether Chapter 78 requires public employees to contribute to their health insurance at the Tier 4 rate for the remainder of a multi-year collective negotiations agreement if the employees reached the Tier 4 contribution rate during that agreement. This is first a question of statutory interpretation. Both PERC and the appellate division agreed on the plain language of the statute. They said yes. We seek to have this court overturn the appellate division's decision and to restrain arbitration. If the court finds that the language of the governing statute is clear, which both PERC and the appellate division found, then that should be the end of the inquiry, and it should restrain arbitration based on 40 years of this court's precedent, starting with the Ridgefield Park Board of Education and the Ridgefield Park Education Association matter in 1978. If this court does not believe that that language is clear, it should still restrain arbitration because it should respect the expertise of PERC, which did find that this language, which directly relates to PERC's expertise in terms of determining the scope of negotiations, PERC determined that this language was clear to it and it should restrain arbitration. This court's own precedent acknowledges that PERC has specific and unique expertise when it comes to public sector collective negotiations and determining what topics are within the scope of negotiations. The statutory language is clear. Up to 35% of the cost of premium is to be paid by public employees, depending on their salary. That was to be phased in over a 4-year period. The question became, when does it become negotiable? The statute answers that question when it reads a public employer and employees who are in negotiations for the next collective negotiations agreement to be executed after the employees in that unit have reached full implementation. The most reasonable reading of this language is that public employees were to continue to contribute at Tier 4 until two things happened. There were negotiations for the next contract to be executed after full implementation, and the public employer and public employees agreed to reduce the amount of that contribution. The legislature chose to include words like next and after that the association wishes were not there, but both PERC and the appellate division held that these words had meaning, and the literal meaning is that negotiations on Chapter 78 contributions were not permissible until the next collective negotiations after full implementation. What is the starting point for negotiations then? That question is also answered by the statute in the language that says that the parties shall conduct negotiations concerning contributions for health care benefits as if the full premium share was included in the prior contract. Tier 4 continues because that's the way collective bargaining works until such time as they finish that contract in which they've reached full implementation. When you apply that clear language to the facts here, Chapter 78 contributions were not negotiable until June of 2018. The first contract following Chapter 78 was a 3-year agreement between July 1st, 2011 and June 30th, 2014. The members of the unit went through Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3 during the life of that contract. Full implementation had not been reached during the life of that contract. The second contract was entered effective July 1st of 2014 through June 30th of 2018. They reached full implementation during the life of that contract. Since the parties reached full implementation during that 14 to 18 collective bargaining agreement, healthcare contributions would not become negotiable until after that point. To determine otherwise is to write those words out of the statute. It was only after the expiration of that contract that they would enter into the next collective negotiation. The appellate division even agreed with this point when it held. Thus, when the parties were negotiating the 14 to 18 CNA, they were not negotiating the next collective negotiations agreement to be executed after the employees in that unit have reached full implementation of the premium share and the terms on healthcare contributions were not subject to collective negotiations. That's at page 18 of the appellate division's decision. Because the appellate division then went on, this decision has several other errors that we implore this court to fix. The first of those is that it incorrectly stated the standard of review. For 40 years, this court has held that PERC has special expertise in determining what is and is not within the scope of public sector negotiations. In Bernards versus Bernards, which is 79 NJ 311, 1979, and Jersey City versus Jersey City, 154 NJ, in 1998, this court established that PERC's determinations are entitled to deference unless arbitrary and capricious, even when interpreting statutes other than the Employee-Employer Relations Act, the EERA. Here, PERC was not just interpreting Chapter 78 in general, but the specific provision within Chapter 78 that addresses collective negotiations. First, what happens when the law sunsets, vis-a-vis the contractual language and starting point of negotiations? And second, when is it negotiable? Those are two areas which are entitled to deference. The appellate division erred when it held that it owed no particular deference to PERC simply because PERC is not charged with administering Chapter 78. PERC determined that the parties were preempted from reducing the association's contribution rate below Tier 4 until June 2018 because the parties had negotiated a four-year deal. That decision was based on the plain language of the statute and was and is entitled to deference.
Can I ask you to help us understand the interplay between the plain language of the statute and the contract in this case? What's the minimum required by the statute regulation for the 2015-2016 year? What's the minimum contribution?
To the 2015-2016 year?
Just by statute. Put the contract to one side for a moment.
By statute, without reference to the year in which they reach full implementation as relates to?
What's the minimum for the 2015-16 year?
1.5% of salary.
Now, turn to the language of the CNA. What does it say?
The language of the CNA, which was carried over from a prior contract, pre-negotiated before they finished Chapter 78, says that it will be 1.5% or whatever is the minimum required.
Is the 2011 CNA 1.5% or the minimum set forth by statute, regulation, or code, which you've just told us is 1.5%?
So, Chief Justice Ravner, the language in that contract was carried over before it was permitted to be negotiated. There is a specific provision in the statute that provides for what the starting point of negotiations is to be. And respectfully, we believe that was because the legislature knew that it would be difficult to get both parties to agree to change that language.
Could the parties have negotiated a straddle agreement, an agreement that straddled the last year of the highest level of contribution before the minimum would return to 1.5%. Is there anything about the law that would have expressly prohibited such a contract from being drafted?
Respectfully, no. There is nothing in the law that would have prohibited the parties from entering into a one-year contract that would have finished the Tier 4 of Chapter 78 in the 14-15 school year.
Right. Could they have negotiated a contract that extended multiple years in which it said that first year you're going to be paying 100% of the required contribution, but years 2 through 4 you'd only pay 1.5%.
No.
Could not do that.
No.
Tell us the express language in the statute that forbids that.
The express language in the statute is that first sentence of 18A 16-17.2, which says a public employer and employees who are in negotiations for the next collective negotiations agreement to be executed after the employees in that unit have reached full implementation.
So it tells us by its terms what happens for the next agreement, but nothing more and nothing less. It doesn't, or does it, forbid some sort of a straddle agreement?
Our position is that it does forbid a straddle agreement, or it wouldn't use those words.
Well, look at those words do not appear as clear to me as they are to you. So let's break them down. So, okay, a public employer, employees who are in negotiations for the next collective negotiations agreement to be executed after the employees in that unit have reached full implementation. Okay, after they have reached full implementation, the next one, they reached full implementation in year one of that 3-year contract. So that would suggest that it's the next contract, not that contract, where the status quo is the fourth tier. Why isn't that a reasonable interpretation of the statute?
Because the way collective bargaining works, you'd have individuals at tier 4 down to 1.5% and then up to 1.
I hear what you're saying. I'm just looking at the statute, what it says. It says collective negotiate to be executed after the employees have reached full implementation. So from 14 to 18, they've reached full implementation. The next collective negotiations agreement is 18 on, according to the statute. It may not make, it may not seem to make sense. You may not like it, but that's the way it reads, no? Well, how am I mistaken in my interpretation?
Wouldn't that reading suggest that it would be 100% for the next through 18? Because that was the contract where they fulfilled so it would be the full percentage for the entirety of the 14-18 contract. Doesn't the language suggest that to you?
The language suggests to us.
So I want to continue to the second half of the sentence because I think that's important as well. Justice Alvin read you the first part about the next collective negotiations after shall be conducted as if the full premium share was included in the prior contract. Doesn't that plain concept simply say, here's the starting point for the next conversation, that you're going to start as if the prior contract had the full contribution? I don't see it seeing anything more or anything less than that. I don't know how you reached the opposite conclusion. Please tell me.
So we reached that opposite conclusion when you look at the entirety of the statute, the intent of the legislature to keep Chapter 78 at Tier 4 going as long as possible. Now, there was a sunset in Tier 4, after Tier 4. However, the legislative intent, when read, coupled with all of the provisions in the statute, which also say, after full implementation, those contribution levels shall become part of the party's collective negotiation.
You've conceded that there could have been a 1-year contract that would have coincided with the sunset of the statute, no?
There could have been a 1-year contract. These parties did not negotiate a 1-year contract.
Did negotiate that 1-year contract, it would have to have been from the understanding that the starting point was 100% of Tier 4 levels, correct?
Correct, Justice Levecchia. Okay. That would have been both the understanding as well as the language in the contract.
Right.
Though many parties have had a very difficult time negotiating that language into the contract.
And do I take it, just one additional follow-up, that from your answers to the questions you've received so far, your position consistently is there has to be negotiation of an entirely new CNA in order to fulfill the legislative intent of this first sentence.
That correct? Is correct, Justice Levecchia.
Okay. It can't be the next year within a multi-year contract in which the first year happens to reach Tier 4.
That is correct. Okay. That is our position.
And what is the purpose of that from the point of view of the legislature? Why is it significant to have a contract negotiated at the point where they have reached Tier 4 as opposed to having a contract, essentially, the numbers go up and then down and then perhaps up again in the same contract?
Justice Patterson, our belief in our interpretation with that is based on the legislative history, that this not be pre-negotiated, that this be a phased in. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just 4 years and done. The legislature set the amount at that up to 35% based on salary, but then phased it in order to not hurt public employees as much as it possibly could. So with that legislative intent, it is our belief, and not just our belief, but PERC's interpretation of this statute, which is entitled to some respect and deference.
How about your interpretation real time? So after that, the first year of the contract, where the fourth tier was paid, how much did you take out of the employee's salary after that?
After the first year, after the 14-15
yeah.
school year? The 1.5%.
And how long did you continue only to take 1.5% out?
I believe it was approximately a year.
Okay, so my question to you is, you see the statute with absolute clarity today. In real time, after the first year, by your actions, you seem to have agreed with the interpretation given by your adversaries. You went right down to the 1.5%. That's precisely what you thought the agreement was all about, no?
So without a factual record before this court, it is very difficult to say that. There was
Ask me your deeds, what you did.
I understand that. So, Justice Altman, I'm answering your question. I was not the board attorney at the time. When I became the board attorney, I asked the board what happened. The Board of Education did not know that any such agreement had been met. And I think that that's important here because right now, and I do not want to publicly disparage my client, they've had a lot of fiscal issues. They've had a lot of upset and unrest in their business office. And quite frankly, the best that I've been able to determine is that they had no idea that someone in their business office had made that change from Tier 4 to 1.5%.
For a full, what, year and a half?
For a full year and a half. They have currently a fiscal monitor appointed by the state. I completely understand your potential disbelief here. They have a fiscal monitor appointed by the state. They've had the Office of Fiscal Accountability and Compliance come in and do an entire audit of this and other issues, and they've also had the Office of Legislative Services come in and do a public audit of their financial situation and decisions that were made by their business office without the proper authority from the Board of Education. So it is conceivable to me, having been there now for several years, that this would happen, and the Board of Education would have no idea. When the memorandum of agreement was discovered, it was clear to me in reading it that it had not been negotiated, or it would have been placed into that somewhat 20-page memorandum of agreement.
So this takes us back to the language of the statute, because the back and forth is not going to be determinative for the outcome here. Would you agree?
I agree, which is, to my point, these issues were issues that should have been brought up. If this court finds that the language is not clear and it is not preempted, it should have gone to an arbitrator. The appellate division should not have done what it did, and I would be able to make these same arguments to an arbitrator.
You're suggesting that 17.2 says that when you have a multi-year contract that extends beyond the year of the 100% contribution, the years beyond are at Tier 4, right?
Correct, Justice.
And yet, that's not what the first sentence says. Would you agree?
I believe that the first sentence can't be read in any other way. There's no other logical way to read that first sentence, because we do not believe that the legislature would have intended that boards and associations could negotiate down in the middle of that contract and then use language that says negotiations for the next collective negotiations will be to be executed after that unit has reached full implementation. So
would any reading other than the one you're giving be inconsistent with the last sentence of 17.2?
The sentence that reads after full implementation?
Yes, which talks about how the collective negotiation from that full implementation level shall be conducted for the next collective negotiation agreement period.
Justice LaVecchia, we believe that that is consistent, and I don't believe that there's any other reading of that first sentence that would allow that last sentence to be read consistently.
Well, the reading that the Chief Justice gave would be that you negotiated in the 2014-2018 fourth tier first year, going down 1.5 for the next 2 years, and The statute says next collective negotiation agreement, you're starting with the fourth tier. That's one reasonable interpretation of the statute. Given the way you negotiated this 2014-2018 agreement. What? No? Why isn't that a fair reading of the statute?
A fair reading of the statute takes in all the aspects of the statute. And if it's not clear on its face, then the legislative intent should be looked at. And the legislator's intent was clear here as well, that it to be continued at Tier 4 as long as possible.
Well, it doesn't say that it doesn't say in the statute. Where does it say that in the statute? That the Tier 4 is supposed to be continued as long as possible during that collective negotiation agreement?
Justice Album, that is not in that specific thing is not in the statute. What I was referring to was that if the statute is not crystal clear on its face, then the court should look to the intent of the legislature for the meanings of these words.
So going back to the last sentence, as Justice Slovakia flagged, after full implementation, that's the sentence you were referring to, Justice.
Correct.
Those contribution levels shall become part of the party's collective negotiations and shall then be subject to collective negotiations in a manner similar to other negotiable items between the parties. How can that legislative statement be realized if you have this zigging and zagging in the course of a single contract that is being maintained by your adversaries?
Justice Patterson, I don't see how it can. I don't believe there is any other logical, reasonable way to read that first sentence when looking at the statute comprehensively.
Because it says after full implementation, you have two temporally separated events, full implementation, and then we're back to the drawing board on negotiations with that as the starting point.
Correct.
Not only that, PERC interpreted the way you are indicating it should be interpreted.
Correct, Your Honor, yes.
And they have the expertise, as we all know. We give deference to administrative agencies because of their expertise.
You're absolutely right. And in this particular case, the Appellate Division did not give any deference and specifically said that PERC was owed no deference. And we disagree with that based on this Court's 40 years of precedent.
We can read words on a piece of paper, I hope, as well as PERC. I can read a sentence and know what it means, I hope, as well as a member of PERC, no?
Justice Alban, I am certainly not suggesting that you can't read these words just as well as PERC. However, what PERC has that Your Honor respectfully may not have is a tremendous amount of expertise when it comes specifically to collective bargaining. This particular piece of legislation, it's not just any piece of legislation. This language here goes to the heart of what PERC is charged with interpreting. PERC has a very limited scope, if I can use that word, in determining what it is to do, right? It has a very limited area, and that area is public sector collective bargaining. This language was basically written for PERC. When does this become negotiable after it sunsets? Question number one. And what is the starting point for collective bargaining? That's very important. Having been a practitioner in this area and serving on my local Board of Education for the last 15 years, the starting point for negotiations is a very important aspect. And PERC is charged with the expertise of knowing that.
I want to go back to legislative intent. You raise a very persuasive argument. The language is ambiguous, and we have to look there. That the legislature was wrestling with a deep fiscal crisis and trying to save money in the way that it structured the phase-in. And yet at the same time, the legislature adopted a sunset clause. There seems to be some tension between those two concepts. How should this court reconcile that tension?
I think this court should understand that any legislation takes bargaining, not collective bargaining like we're doing here, but it does take bargaining, and I think that sunsetting was the result of a give and take. But the initial push from the legislature in all of the materials that we did include before the Appellate Division and is in the record makes it clear that the overarching intent was to shift some of the burden of skyrocketing healthcare costs from the public taxpayers to public employees.
The sunset, that is the end of the, when it becomes negotiable again, is at a tier four level, correct?
Correct.
So for the purpose of negotiation, the status quo at the sunset is tier four.
That is correct, Justice Holmes.
So whatever you're negotiating, whenever you're negotiating it, you're starting at the status quo for negotiating purposes, meaning tier four, not 1.5%, but tier four.
That is correct.
Can we look at, I'm sorry, Justice, you done?
I'm done.
Can we look at the sentence that begins with the word employees? Because in the same statute, the legislature addressed yet again, in a different variation, the same problem that we're grappling with here. How to understand the sunset provision and then the beginning of negotiations in an ensuing contract period. And in that sentence, they're talking about grandfathering in existing CNAs as of the time Chapter 78 comes into effect that might take it past its life beyond the sunset date of Chapter 78, but it still says, the legislature still says, you have to go past that sunset date, implement all four tiers as required, and then negotiate from a status quo point of that tier four level. Is that yet again an indication of legislative intent as to how all of these statutes and all of these scenarios that the legislature was consistently messaging it, how it wanted it implemented? Is that consistent with what we're talking about in sentence one?
I agree completely, Justice LaVecchia.
But it doesn't say that after the fourth tier has been implemented, and that it's mandatory that the fourth tier be at the top tier for the fifth year or the sixth year. And there were collective negotiations in this case where you agreed to 1.5%. So I'm trying to figure out why, if you had collective negotiations for 1.5% from 2014 to 2018, and the fourth year is completed in the first year, that these collective negotiations that you engaged in go by the wayside, and now it's at the fourth tier. I'm trying to figure that how that happens.
To answer the first part of your question, Justice Alvin, there were no collective negotiations that specifically agreed that 1.5% would be the second, third, and fourth year of that contract. That language, at the best, was simply carried over from one contract to the next, which happens very frequently in many contracts and collective bargaining, and which is why I believe that the legislature placed this language that said the starting point is to be tier four, because the legislature realized that there would be times, and there have been times.
Well, without fact-finding, and this is what you said going back to an arbitrator, maybe this, how do we know that all of this wasn't taken into consideration when they were negotiating 2014-2018. Maybe the parties understood, okay, by statute the fourth year is going to be at the top, and after that it's 1.5. Or maybe they understood something different. And isn't that the argument for fact-finding through an arbitrator?
Absolutely, 100%, Justice Alvin. I agree with you completely. If this court does not believe that this language was preempted, if it's preempted, that's the end of the inquiry, unless this court wants to vastly expand scope determinations.
The second
aspect is, yes, these parties agreed through collective bargaining that their fact finder would be an arbitrator. And the appellate division took that from them in making determinations on what the parties would have
and
done.
What we
doesn't the second?
And what we okay. What we can't know. Let's say we accepted your interpretation of this. Maybe during this negotiations, they said after the fourth. Oh yeah, the status quo is the fourth tier, but we will agree that it'll be 1.5, and we'll just like carry over the other one. We don't. That could be the case, right?
Does it the
accepting,
second point?
Accepting your hypothetical, if these parties had sat down and negotiated and said absolutely 1.5% for years 2, 3, and 4, the outcome would still be the same. We'd still be standing here saying that under a scope determination, the scope is limited. Is this language preempted? In every single scope determination that has come before any court, there's language in a contract that was collectively bargained. And the court or PERC has said, you weren't allowed to collectively bargain over that particular aspect, and it comes out of the contract. This is really no different. It seems very different because we're talking about a lot of money, but it's no different than any other scope determination that's come before this court.
Doesn't the second paragraph of the statute expressly prohibit that? It says that employees subject to any collective negotiations agreement in effect on the effective date of 78 that has an expiration date on or after the expiration of sections 39 through 44 inclusive shall be subject upon expiration of that collective negotiations agreement to sections 39 and 41 until the health care contribution set forth in section 41 is fully implemented. Doesn't that suggest that if you meet it during the new collective bargaining agreement, negotiation agreement, then you're bound by that till the end of that one and you can negotiate with the next one? Isn't that pretty clear that that's what this suggests?
Yes, Justice Fernandez-Vina, we think that's
the correct way to read the very last clause, until the health care contribution schedule set forth in section 41 is fully implemented?
We believe that the entire language needs to be read together. So on that section that's specific, until the health care contribution schedule set forth is fully implemented, I believe that that language is meant to refer back to the start, and I believe Justice Patterson may have raised the issue of the start of collective negotiations. If you were already in a contract previously, that the tier one would not start until such time as you finished your prior collective negotiations agreement. I believe that that paragraph is meant to reflect that continuation, that no matter when you start tier one, you have to go through tier four. And then when you read the entirety of the statute, we see that there's really no other way to interpret at least that very first sentence consistent with the other sentences and the intent of the legislature.
The appellate division said that this is an absurd result and it can't be right and it's contrary to public policy. And your adversaries make an argument that when you combine the concept of an absurd result where everything depends on the length of the contract, ordinarily not the most important consideration, but in this case perhaps dispositive, with the conduct of the board in what it did, and essentially I think what they're arguing is that after the PERC determination in Clementon, the board just regrouped and had a new strategy. That's the argument. I'm seeing a cent here. I have it sort of right, I hope.
I do believe that's their argument.
That's their argument. Okay. So they say absurd result and result that you would have agreed was absurd before the PERC determination in Clementon. Why are they wrong?
Justice Patterson, I think that's a good question. I think that why the appellate division is wrong is that they basically made a few reasons. One, when this court has looked at that, the construction of an absurd result, this court has looked at the entirety of a statute being inconsistent. If you look at the plain language of a statute and it is inconsistent with the entire statutory scheme, it would be an absurd result. We have yet to find a case where it is applied in the way that the appellate division applied it here.
Right, but my question is a little bit different, and that is the appellate division is saying if it all depends on whether you happen to be lucky enough to be in a one-year contract or unlucky enough to be in a four-year contract or three, that's not according to public policy. That shouldn't be determinative. And your adversaries combine that with what actually happened here and the timing of the positions taken by the board at different times as compared with the timing of the Clementon decision by PERC. And the suggestion is you saw an opportunity, your client saw an opportunity, that's a good argument, we'll go with it at that time. So why is that argument, why should we not consider those two concepts together? And I understand your argument that absurd results is not properly found by the appellate division.
Justice Patterson, if what you're asking is related to the 1 year and the 3 year, Our position has been that the legislature is meant to know when there are other statutes out there. And there was another statute that permits boards of education to enter into 1-year, 2-year, 3-year, 4-year, or 5-year collective bargaining agreements. These parties agreed on a 4-year agreement simply because they could have entered into a 1-year agreement and then done something differently. Does not make the statutory language read any differently.
From your experience in this area, suppose the statute read utterly crisply and cleanly and said, if you enter into a 4-year agreement, you will remain at Tier 4 for all the remaining years after the sunset clause. In your experience, how would that have affected negotiations? Would groups have been likely to enter into multi-year contracts if the language were that clear?
I think they would have.
Yes, can you explain, tell us why?
Sure. And school boards is here also as amicus, so they have some information on how collective bargaining has worked over the years. But I've spent the last 13 years on my own local board of education. And boards of education and unions enter into agreements for different lengths for all different reasons. And I do not specifically believe that this language, if interpreted that way, would have necessarily impacted the way that the length of negotiations. There are many contracts from boards of ed across the state where they entered into longer contracts. Specifically on my board of education, we were in a very similar place, and we entered Tier 4 in the first year of a new agreement. The union requested that we enter into a 1-year and a 3-year agreement, and we said no. And ended up entering into a 4-year agreement. So I do not think that if that language had been crystal clear or not, you would have seen much difference.
Other questions, anyone? Anything else you'd like to add at this point?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Ashford.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices. May it please the Court. I, as representative of the New Jersey School Boards Association, we come here just to, while we weren't certainly involved at in the matter below, nor would we be should this court seek to reverse and remand the appellate division back to PERC for some sort of proceeding. We come here highly concerned about the appellate division's decision and the chilling effect that it may have on scope of negotiation petitions in the future. It is a very useful tool. It is a tool that not just school boards, but municipalities, that all entities use often. And in this case, the appellate division took it upon themselves to make a decision that was not in their realm of expertise, respectfully. Again, PERC has that expertise, and this was taken out from under them.
The PERC statute does allow for an appeal to the appellate division on scope of negotiations.
Yes, Justice. Procedurally, yes. It's not here inappropriately.
The legislature obviously views the appellate division as having the expertise to review a PERC determination.
Understood. But if every scope of negotiations petition had to ultimately come through this forum, it would just be an overburden of the system beyond belief.
Well, your point is not that they reviewed a determination about scope of negotiations. It's that the appellate division went ahead and then decided the question of the scope. Isn't that correct?
Correct, Justice Levesque.
Okay, that's absolutely a little different.
And that's what brings us here today. So we are. That is what we are, essentially, that is what our issue is today. Again, if the appellate division had found that Chapter 78 had been preempted, that should have been the end of the analysis. If they felt the record needed some more bolstering, then there exists within PERC, and they do it all the time, a proper procedure in which that could have happened.
Is it your position that no matter what the nature of the scope of negotiations dispute is, that PERC is always entitled to deference?
Yes.
Even if, and I it's hard to envision, maybe you could, even if the scope of negotiations is determined based on a statute that really has very little relationship to PERC's expertise. And I don't know if that's possible, but let's say it is.
They should be given deference to the extent deemed appropriate if it were to go any further, but they, that should be the first step, that they should be given deference. Yes.
PERC's taking no position on this.
Correct.
How should we read that?
I cannot speak for them, respectfully.
You don't have a guess?
I cannot.
Okay.
And just very, very, very briefly, counsel for the board spoke a little bit about the history of negotiations. What we did provide in our appellate brief below, and it was on page 14 of our brief below, was a footnote at the bottom that noticed that there was a slight uptick in the number of one-year contracts that occurred around the time in question based on our census. We found that it was our belief that at the time that may have been directly attributable to this Chapter 78 issue, and that districts were very well aware of what was going on, that they were not unaware and were not, you know, hit from behind without any knowledge that this was going to happen, and that they did indeed start negotiating these one-year contracts, which do happen all the time.
What was the level of the uptick?
We went from what we believed in, or from what our numbers said, approximately, we saw 12% in 2016-2017. And historically, it had been less than 5% in the past, as far as our records go back.
Is it possible to tell which party wanted the one-year contract, whether it was the board or the union?
Not based on our data, no. We just know what it was negotiated. But when to the extent that the appellate division said that this was gymnastics and that this was unreasonable and absurd, one-year contracts are not we do not find them to be absurd. They are a strategy, just as if a two-year, a three-year, a four-year, a five-year contract can be used for whatever purpose it may need to be used. It is not unnecessarily burdensome. It is simply a tool, and in this case, that was a perfectly legitimate tool that could have been used in these cases.
And that's within negotiations, whether it's 1 year, 2 year, or whatever.
Yes, the law allows for 1 year through 5 year contracts.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Not. Thank you very much for your time, Justices.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. What the board would like to do in this case is expand the statutory mandate of Chapter 78 from 4 years, to 4 years, 7 years, based on what? Based on the luck of the structure of a contract. So under that configuration, Exhibit A is a winner. Union A, excuse me, is a winner. Union B is a loser. Union C is a winner. Union D is a loser. There's been a lot of discussion of the appellate division's decision, and I don't know if the court is aware of this or not, but I think it's telling that the opinion was written by Judge Sumners. Why? Because Judge Sumners was a school board management labor lawyer for 25 years before he took the bench.
I hate to interrupt
you. Okay.
I just don't think that is an appropriate argument.
I'll move on. We know that, and I would suggest to the court that to allow Chapter 78 to be expanded from 4 years to 4 years, 7 years, should be met with a resounding no by this court. We have, as you've already pointed out, the language of the contract, which is crystal clear, 1.5%. The parties agreed that Tier 4 would obtain in year one. Year two, three, and four at 1.5%. The board says, well, if you hear the board today, well, we didn't know about that. Well, how could they not know about it? They signed the agreement. Every other provision of the contract was implemented. It was an integrated contract. Not only that, we know, as you've already pointed out, Your Honors, from the conduct of the parties. The conduct of the parties was, we understood it was going to be year one, tier four, and then it was going to be 1.5% for years two, three, and four. What changed? Only one thing changed: PERC's decision in Clementon. And really, what I think we're talking about here is a legal doctrine that you have not yet acknowledged in your case law, which is the doctrine of, look at what I found. Look at what I found. So in the board said they didn't know this, but it's telling that the contract was signed in June, and by November, December, they're already demanding the money back because Clementon had been decided. If they weren't aware of it, how did they know about it? Because it was common knowledge, because the party signed the agreement, it was ratified by the board, and the board administrator, the school administrator, as in every other case, administers that contract. The appellate division panel in this case got it right. The two key points of the rationale are just plain old-fashioned common sense. As they said, the construction by PERC creates an absurd result. And I think it's already been said, perhaps by Justice Albin, that if the legislature wanted employees to pay at Tier 4 levels beyond 1 year, it could have easily said so. The court also said that the configuration here is a draconian result with procedural gymnastics. This court has reviewed, I can't say how many scope decisions over the years, but did you ever see a PERC decision that included a workaround where they say, oh, well, it's non-negotiable if you put it in one contract, but if you break it down into one and three, it's fine. And by the way, I think that in answer to the question that was raised about who, to Ms. Asher, who were the parties who were looking for the one-year agreements after Clementon came down, that was the unions. The unions were looking for that so they could avoid the result that happened in Clementon and then happened in Ridgefield. It's a short-sighted view by PERC. Now,
So we start with the contract, which says, look to the minimum set forth by statute, regulation, or code. That takes us to 17.2, and you heard the back and forth in the earlier arguments about what 17.2 precisely says, and I'm sure you'll address that, but if it's ambiguous, if it can be read both ways, how do you address the fact that the legislative intent appears to have been to grab hold of the fiscal problem at the moment and increase the contribution level?
I don't know that that's correct. I think that it's, frankly, sloppy draftsmanship, that they did not realize or think about the fact that because of the phase-in, that contrast could start at different times in implementing the tiers.
You're saying the statute's sloppy draftsmanship or the contract?
The statute is sloppy draftsmanship.
Oh, the statute.
Okay. Yes, because, and that happens.
So if that's the case and we look to legislative intent, what does that tell us?
I think it tells us that they had an intent of that there would be four tiers phased in over 4 years, and that after that period of time, that you could negotiate a reduction in that amount. In these negotiations, tier four for some people meant 35%. Obviously, the unions are going to look to reduce that amount. Neither party had the benefit of Clementon when they bargained, but they knew that they had to complete tier four, and nobody said boo about the fact that, you know, we had that the union had to pay tier four. They paid tier four.
Does that reading of the legislature's intent fully consider the fact that they were sending a message here that the next contract should be treated as though you were at Tier 4, and the language in the last sentence of 17.2 as well?
But the language, I don't want to be disrespectful, but it's so ignorant of what happens in bargaining. You don't just complete a contract, as these folks did, with 1 year sitting out there and say, okay, let's then, because we're stuck with this language, have to negotiate a 1 year agreement and then a 3 year. What about all of the language in the EERA about, you know, labor peace, about, you know.
Given your interpretation of the contract, of the statute, when does the fourth tier status quo, when is it triggered?
It's triggered when you're bargaining the contract.
Let me be more precise. Was it triggered at some point during the 2014-2018 negotiations, or, given your interpretation of the statute, does that status quo fourth tier begin in the 2018 onward negotiations? Are you following me?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. I think that, you know, it's ambiguous, but I think that
I'm asking you for your interpretation. What's your position?
My position is that the statute, well, in this particular case, the parties read it that they should complete Tier 4 and then bargain over.
I think Justice Alvin respectfully is looking for how you view it to mean, and I understand you probably have a lot of different cases where this could go in lots of different directions, but.
Well, actually, I had two cases pending, Richfield Park and the Gloucester Township FOP at the same time. I got the appellate division, the presiding judge, to stay the briefing in Gloucester Township. After Richfield Park was decided, the township and the police immediately agreed to a new contract, which adjusted the Chapter 78 rates.
Based on the appellate division's decision?
Based on the appellate division's decision, and I'm not aware of any other cases.
Chances are there are no new ones coming up.
No,
this is all,
not at all.
This
was
a frozen
the unicorn, so to speak.
But you're still not answering my question, and
right.
It goes to your interpretation of the statute, because apparently we hear that there are two readings dealing with until, to be executed after the employees in that unit have reached full implementation of the premium share. Now, your adversaries are saying that was during the 2014-2018 contract, and therefore that fourth tier carried on. So my question is, the status quo, which is supposed to be at the fourth tier, you're supposed to be starting at that point for collective negotiations, was that triggered during the 2014-18 collective negotiations agreement, or was that supposed to begin at the 2018 onward? Ball's in your court.
The way I see it is that it's not, I just can't give you a definitive answer on that because I look to other language in 18A16-17.1. I look at the section which starts with the word, once these employees are subjected to, and goes on to say, notwithstanding, and this is to the sunset question that you raised, Justice LaVecchia, notwithstanding the expiration date set forth in Section 83 of this Act, or the expiration date of any successor agreements, the parties shall be bound to apply the requirements of this paragraph until they have reached the full implementation of the schedule. Well, they've reached the full implementation of the schedule in the first year.
I know, but you could even in the first 2014, you could still have agreed to the top tier in the fifth and sixth years too. Right?
That's correct. But certainly in the successor contract, they would have the right to bargain over, you know, the Chapter 78 contributions. You're talking about the one that goes beyond 18.
If we accept your interpretation, you would have to agree that during the collective negotiations for the 2014-2018 contract, you'd have to abide by the statute, which would say that you start with the presumption you're at the fourth tier, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Is there anything in the record to indicate that that's the way the negotiations began for the 2014-2018 negotiations?
Yes, there's the SCORCA certification. That was presented to PERC.
Now there's a challenge about the appropriateness of that certification, no? By your adversaries?
Well, they say that, but there is a specific PERC reg on point.
You're saying 1913-30.6.
Right, which says, F, all briefs filed with the commission, and this is in the scope of negotiations case, 1, recite all pertinent facts supported by certifications based upon personal knowledge. That's what it says. And in fact, if you look, this court just denied certification in another case I had, where the board presented petition for certification, City of Burlington. And right in PERC's decision in City of Burlington, the superintendent had certified to the facts. I said, I acknowledge this requirement, F1, but I don't dispute the facts that the superintendent provided, just the application of facts, of the facts, and I'm not providing a certification.
But this is a legal...
And the appellate division...
I thought the question being asked of you is an interpretation of the statute, not what one party to the negotiation thought about the statute.
I understand that, but that was critical to the analysis, that
if there was a remand for a scope hearing, but we're talking about a legal interpretation of a statute that PERC interpreted and addressed a preemption question. I thought that was the question that Justice Albin was asking you.
And
a legal question, Mr. Cohen, that's why the certification doesn't help in the answer.
Well, it seems that even if you accepted PERC, their decision is being correct. What you're saying is, even if you accept that interpretation, you said we negotiated this 2014-2018 in accordance with the law. We considered that the fourth year would be the presumptive, and all the parties knew that, and we agreed to the first year at fourth year and each succeeding year at 1.5. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And I also, as to the PERC decision, I believe that PERC's decision was financially driven. Remember, at this period of time, we have been before this court twice, Robbinsville and County of Atlantic, where PERC was reversed, and this court and the appellate division said in no certain terms that these decisions were not based upon interpretations of the Act.
If you're correct, why isn't this going back for arbitration, which is what your adversaries are suggesting? At the very least, the appellate division shouldn't have been making fact-finding, because it seems there would be at least a dispute as to what was negotiated, no?
No. No.
No?
The language is clear.
Is there supposed to be fact-finding in a scope of negotiations determination?
As as to what's within the scope. But here...
Let's pause that, because is there supposed to be fact-finding as to who did what in the scope of negotiations determination? Tell me if I'm wrong. I thought that in a scope of negotiations determination, Perkis is statutorily given a very narrow question to answer, and that is this a proper subject of negotiation? Should it be political? Should it be a political process that deals with it? Or that's been said many times. Is PERC supposed to be, and or is the appellate division reviewing PERC, supposed to be making determinations as to what actually happened?
If it impacts the determination, the scope determination, it should. There have been cases going back 40 years that say that. There was a case that I had in 1982, Cam Vogt, 183 NJ Super 206, Judge King. And if I recall correctly, he said that if the scope determination it turns on the facts, PERC should decide that, and referenced the right to ask for an evidentiary hearing, which the board didn't do here.
There's nothing in the statute that I see that mandates that the fifth and sixth and seventh years be at the fourth tier if they're not negotiated at the fifth and sixth and seventh years at the fourth tier. Am I mistaken?
Correct. And that is our point, that there's nothing in the statute that says that Tier 4 must go on. What's happened here is because PERC misguidedly, I think, looked at the structure of the contract rather than what the legislature really intended. I believe the legislature really intended that the parties would go through the four tiers, and then they would be able to bargain, something less. But nothing in the that statute, chapter 78, says you can't do it in one document.
What about that last sentence, which has been alluded to a number of times? Let me just find it. I want to be precise. Give me a moment. The sentence that says, after full implementation, those contribution levels shall become part of the party's collective negotiations and shall then be subject to collective negotiations in a manner similar to other negotiable items between the parties. Doesn't that mean you go through a contract, and I appreciate your comments that the legislature may not have understood how things really work in the real world, but this can happen, as Clementon demonstrates. Doesn't that indicate the legislature meant you go through the tiering all the way through, and then you can negotiate from there?
I'll respond to you the way I responded in the appellate division, which is, in what corner of the universe are parties to a labor agreement, or for that matter, any contract, not permitted to agree to contract terms that anticipate a known change in economic conditions? Why can't the parties anticipate, okay, we're going to bargain for a contract. We want labor stability. We really want to have peace. We want a four-year contract.
Does your response indicate that you think the legislature was envisioning that, but it's not realistic? Is that what you're saying?
That's very possible. It's not. It's just not realistic at all.
So if this court, charged with statutory interpretation and not making policy judgments about whether the legislature is good, bad, or indifferent about the policy, if our job is, as it is, to interpret, unless there's a constitutional challenge, we don't have that here, to interpret what the legislature meant, isn't our job done if they did it? You can argue it's wrong, you can argue it's misguided, you can argue it doesn't take into account the real world that you, respectfully, you do live in the collective negotiations agreements, but isn't our job done if that's what the legislature said?
I don't believe so. Not if it doesn't make any sense, and it reduces that language to an absurdity, as the appellate division said.
Is the absurdity that the workaround, as you refer to it in the PERC context, is you go temporarily to a 1 year, and you get around it.
And how isn't that antithetical to what the Employer-Employee Relations Act is?
I can't answer your question. I know you're asking for a question.
What I'm saying is, why would the legislature want piecemeal contracts when they've already said in this act, the EERA, that our goal is labor stability and labor peace? Why would they want, instead of the parties, to agree to a 4-year deal? No, you go for a 1-year deal and a 3-year deal. Makes no sense.
And I know you're not addressing these questions for me to answer, but
I'm not.
But you do appreciate, I know, because of your long experience in this, that our job is to determine what the legislature wanted, and really not go beyond that to say somehow runs up against the Constitution. Really not go beyond it to say, well, it could have done it a different way that would have made life easier for everybody or would have been more consistent with the ERA. That our job is to figure out what the legislature wanted.
But sometimes, for example, there's a case, County of Monmouth, where it's an appellate division case reported, I think it's 300 NJ Super, where, remember when the legislature passed a statute that said you could arbitrate minor discipline if it was 5 days or less. And they used different language. And it was very confusing. And the appellate division said, well, it can't possibly be that if it's 6 days or more, you can go to civil service. And if it's 4 days or less, you can go to binding arbitration. But if you have a 5-day suspension, you have to file an action in lieu of prerogative writs. And they said that makes no sense. And they said the legislature must have intended 5 days or less minor discipline, more than 5 days major discipline, civil service.
And on the issues before us, anything else you'd like to add to your presentation?
No, Your Honor.
I think we have your position, so thank you. Mr. Mintz.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. First, on the issue of deference, when I was at PERC, I argued repeatedly that the courts should give PERC full deference on all scopes of negotiations decisions, but the reality is that when it comes to interpreting a statute that's not the PERC statute, PERC has traditionally gotten less deference from the courts. I have a different sense of, from what I'm hearing, of this issue of the meaning of full implementation. The legislature's intent, as we understand it, was that full implementation meant that the employee had to reach Tier 4. And after full implementation, the issue was negotiable. So that we saw that in different ways. The legislature had a sunset provision and said that if you haven't reached Tier 4 by the time the statute sunsets, nevertheless, you still got to continue until you reach full implementation, until you reach Tier 4, and then the subject becomes negotiable. And that relates also to what is the status quo language? What is that language in Section 17.2 that says after full implementation, the matter then becomes negotiable? After Tier 4, it's negotiable. What does it mean to say that the parties have to treat it as if Tier 4 becomes the status quo? What that means is when these parties, and we were not involved in this, we're an amicus, but when these parties We're negotiating that 2014 to 2018 contract. The first year had to be Tier 4. It's preempted by statute. Had to be Tier 4. And then when they were negotiating for what years 2, 3, and 4 would be, the status quo, the burden with the status quo is Tier 4, and the burden was on the union to get something less than Tier 4 if they wanted something less than Tier 4.
Mr. Mintz, you said it shall be negotiable, and I think you would if the statute said it shall be negotiable and nothing more, you'd have a really, really great argument. It says a couple of things that suggest a breaking point between contracts. One is the reference, a public employer and employees who are in negotiations for the next collective negotiations agreement. And I know you know this statute, I'm sure, by heart. And secondly is that last sentence that I was just discussing with your colleague. After full implementation, then et cetera, about collective negotiations. Why doesn't that suggest, and I'm not getting into the wisdom of it, but why doesn't that suggest there is a finishing point with one CNA and a starting point with the next?
Well, the full implementation language just doesn't say that. Full implementation, the intent of the legislature was that public employees for the first time, well, there was the 1.5% statute.
Right.
And now that wasn't enough. Fiscal crisis, whatever the reasons. We all know we had litigation about the pension case. I don't want to revisit that. But employees are going to have to contribute more. They're going to have to contribute a percentage of premium based on their salaries, and they're going to have to do it for 4 years, and we're going to phase it in. Tier 1 would be a quarter, Tier 2 would be a half, Tier 3 would be three quarters, and Tier 4 would be the full percent of premium. And then after that, it's negotiable again.
If
the
it
statute
said that,
goes away.
But that was the intent of the legislature. But they talked about the next collective negotiations agreement to be executed as the time to go back to negotiating. And they also talked about after full implementation, those contribution levels shall become part of the collective negotiations. Implementation, negotiations, and potentially some relief for the employees.
Okay, the word next gives us pause because it's not crystal clear. I don't have any problem with the full implementation language because to me, full implementation meant once you reach Tier 4, that statutory mandate has been fully implemented. And now it's subject to negotiations, and so you can negotiate for a lower contribution the next year.
Okay, but let's talk about next.
Okay.
We have to, and you understand.
Yes.
You know, you're just obviously a veteran of many, many appeals. You understand we have to just look at this and say, what did they mean?
Okay.
Next,
and then,
where would they get next collective negotiations agreement if it's just Tier 3 of a continuing same agreement? Why would they use the word next collective negotiations agreement to be executed?
I can't tell you why they used the word next, and there's no legislative history that tells us why they used the word next.
Well, maybe they didn't. Maybe they meant the next one.
Well, maybe they did, and maybe they didn't. And if you don't know, then you look at the context. You look at what the legislature's intent was, which was that employees would pay a contribution for 4 years.
But it's a little bit more than that, because under the first sentence, as your colleague across the aisle put it out, the Tier 4 comes back for the negotiation of the next contract. That's the starting point. Do you disagree with that?
I don't think it comes back for the next contract.
It comes back as the starting point for the negotiation. Do you have a different read of that?
Yeah, I think it means once you've reached Tier 4, unless the union negotiates something less than Tier 4, Tier 4 is the status quo and it continues.
But you didn't reach Tier 4 when you began your 2014 negotiations. So that wouldn't have kicked in. It would seem that the next collective negotiation agreement would have been when Tier 4 had been fully implemented.
Well, that's the next language, which was the earlier section of the statute, not the full implementation part of the statute, which from our perspective just means once you've reached Tier 4, employees, you fulfilled your statutory responsibility to pay one quarter, one half, three quarters, four quarters.
When you're referring to the full implementation language, are you talking about the first or the last sentence of 17?
I'm talking about the last sentence and even...
I was talking about the first because the language appears in both.
Yes, it does. And I think full implementation means once you've reached Tier 4. That's how we interpret full implementation.
So as to the first sentence, do you have a different read? Is the starting point the 1.5 or is it as if the full premium share were included, meaning Tier 4?
I'm sorry, I'm not.
What's the starting point?
Starting point
in the
for
sentence, the first sentence of 17.2.
Yes.
For the next collective negotiation.
Well, I think that can be read as it was by PERC to mean the subsequent contract. But I don't think that makes any sense in terms of what the legislature intended, and that's what the appellate division said.
Those the are legislature. Their words. That's the legislature's words. Why doesn't that give us a good indication of what they intended?
Because it's ambiguous as to what that means, and it's inconsistent with other parts of that same statute, which intended and said that you had to reach Tier 4.
So just to be clear, I'm not asking you what it tells us about years 5 and 6. I'm asking you what it tells us about the starting point for negotiations for the next contract.
For the next contract
after
what?
Full implementation.
After full implementation, I don't think it says anything about a subsequent contract. I know there was discussion earlier about, well, could this apply to the contract? If the parties had agreed that in year one you'd be at Tier 4 and then go down to 1.5% as these parties did in this case, I think it's even more absurd to think that the status quo for the next contract would go back up to Tier 4.
So what does the first sentence mean? What meaning does your read of it give to that language altogether?
I think that you have to read that sentence, which I think is unclear what the word next means. You have to read it in the context of the legislature scheme, which is that employees pay Tier 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the subject become negotiable again. I mean, this is not even a statute which just says it shall become negotiable again. It says the statute goes away, but there's an exception. If you haven't reached Tier 4 yet.
Agreed, but it's a question of when. Okay, next, you say PERC's interpretation, which is the board's, is a plausible interpretation, which means it's the next one. What's the alternative meaning of next?
The alternative is, well, I don't...
Do you have one for us?
If you give me 10 seconds.
I'll give you much more time, believe me. You were kind enough to give me some time to look at my notes.
I mean, I think that you can argue that the contract in which governs after Tier 4 is the next collective negotiations agreement, and that this contract that's in dispute in this case is one that Tier 4 was reached in the first year, and so this is the contract
that is next.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interpretation.
How could it be the next one? I understand.
Well, it's not the next contract. It's the next set of negotiations. It's the next agreement. It's the agreement that governs what happens after the employees reach Tier 4. PERC's result...
Isn't that agreement a contract?
Sure.
So why are you saying it's not a contract? It's an agreement.
Well, I'm not meaning to
just
draw
wondering.
Any distinction between it being a contract and agreement. And if I did, I misspoke.
I want to just clarify what you're saying so that we get it. In terms of the three agreements in this case, what is the first sentence referring to?
In terms of the three agreements?
The 2014 to 18 or the 2011 to 14? What was it that you were suggesting?
I was suggesting that the agreement that governs what happens after full implementation is the next agreement.
Right. So which one is it?
Well, that would be the 14 to 18 agreement.
Okay.
Because they needed to reach Tier 4. That was preempted. The preemption goes away after the employees reach Tier 4.
It says to be executed after the employees in that unit have reached full implementation. What's the date on which the employees under the 2014-18 agreement reach full implementation?
They reach full implementation during year one of the 14 to 18
agreement. At that point, the 2014-18 had already been executed. So what is the agreement that is to be executed after the employees in that unit have reached full implementation? It can't be 2014 to 18 because that one was executed before they reached full implementation.
I can't disagree that is not a valid interpretation. I don't think it's the only interpretation, and I think it goes back to what the appellate division said, which is it's an absurd result for the PERC's Clementon approach to be the law in the scope of negotiations.
I don't know why it's absurd.
I'm sorry.
Reading the plain language suggests that the status quo is at the fourth tier, and the status quo during the 2014-2018 was never at the fourth tier because the fourth tier hadn't been fully implemented. So other than the first year of the 2014-2018 contract, which had to be at the fourth tier, the parties were free to negotiate without any status quo for the second and third year. It wasn't until the next, the 2018 contract. It's not a great legislative scheme, but if you read it strictly, it would. That's one reading of it. No, are you following me?
Well, if you're saying that in year one, in the 2014 year, it had to be a tier four.
It had
four,
to be.
And then 14. For years 2, 3, and 4, you could go down to 1.5%.
Yeah,
I think.
But once you get to 2018, now
it
you're
goes
at the
back
fourth,
up to tier
yeah.
four. That makes even less sense to me than the interpretation that Perk
it may
came
make
up with.
Less sense to you, but isn't that a reading of this, of that the first sentence of 17.2?
Well, this court has often said that you need to have read statutes in a common sense way, and that just to me is not commonsensical to say that the parties could have negotiated down to 1.5%, and then when that contract is over, the union now has the burden because the status quo bumps it up to...
But we don't have an impossibility situation here. Sometimes statutes are written in a way that creates just a situation where you can't comply with them. There is a method of compliance here, and that is you do what you can do, and apparently, according to School Boards Association, there was an uptick in this, is you go to a 1 year for 1 year. That's all you do. Get it done, and then go on to your whatever length of terms you wanted to do. That's allowed by the law. And I understand, you know, I have great respect for you and your colleague saying that this is not the best way to do it or a good way to do it or a realistic way, and it causes some bumps in the road, as it were, but it can be complied with within the legal framework of the EERA.
Yeah, if you read the statute as commanding that, but this argument began with the question to counsel of whether or not for the 2015, or the second year, 15-16, whether or not the parties, whether the statute commanded that it be anything other than 1.5%, and I think our position is the statute says 1.5 was the minimum, that there was nothing in the statute other than maybe that, I'll use the word, maybe tortured is too strong a word, but the interpretation of next to mean that for some parties out there, you're going to have to pay tier four for more than 1 year, and for other public employees, you only have to pay tier four for 1 year. That I don't see anything in the statute, in anywhere in Chapter 78, that suggests that the legislature intended that. And this,
I think we have your position. Is there anything you wanted to end on?
No, I think that's it.
Thank you.
Brief rebuttal, Ms. Wright.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and I will be very brief. As I said previously, I believe that the language in the statute cannot reasonably and logically be read any differently than what we have asserted. However, if that is not the belief of this court, then the next step is to look at the legislature's intent and to provide deference to PERC. I think Justice Patterson asked the question of one of my colleagues about the determination of a scope petition and the deference to PERC when it's interpreting a statute outside of the EERA. Our position, based on this court's precedent in Bernards Township and in Jersey City, is that PERC is still entitled to deference when determining what is within the scope of collective negotiations.
Isn't that the heart of a preemption question that comes up in the scope question? Isn't PERC necessarily required to interpret other statutes outside of the EER, Employee Relations Act, and
absolutely
does so with the school laws and civil service laws and local governmental entity laws all the time?
Absolutely, absolutely. And this court has said that even in those circumstances,
PERC is entitled
to that deference and that respect because it is their expertise that determines what's the scope of negotiation.
And your point on the legislative history, please.
If the statute is not clear, then the court can look to legislative history to see if it can determine what the legislature intended.
And what does that tell us in this case?
I believe clearly that the legislature intended that this be a four-year phase-in and that the parties of every collective bargaining agreement remain at Tier 4.
Where is that? Cite us to, is that in some Senate statement or Assembly statement? You said the legislative history.
There is quite a bit of legislative history in
tell us what supports that interpretation in legislative history.
I do not have it at the ready, Justice Alvin. I apologize. I can.
Do you rely as well on the broader legislative concern about increasing contribution?
That is correct, Chief Justice Ravner, that the larger legislative intent here and the statutory scheme as a whole. The only thing that I wanted also to just end on, 2 points. One, the one-year agreement is not an absurdity. It is something that the legislature permits for all boards of education. If the legislature did not want one-year agreements and didn't think that one and thought that one-year agreements would lead to labor instability, then the legislature certainly had the ability to remove one-year agreements from the statute that allows boards of ed to enter into one-year agreements, and they didn't. So I do not believe that that is an absurdity. And the only other part that I wanted just to end on is to Justice Patterson's point about the inquiry here. If this court determines that the legislature intended to preempt this, then that is the end of the inquiry. And the appellate division overstepped its boundaries with its remedy here. It took from PERC, it took from the parties their right to go to arbitration. Fact-finding should have been done by an arbitrator rather than the appellate division based on its belief that we would have had a crystal ball, we would have done something differently. In fact, the fact that the language of the statute can be subject to varying interpretations, as we've spent more than an hour today discussing, is the very reason why the appellate division cannot assume to know what the parties would have negotiated in this case. So respectfully, we request that the court follow its precedent by reinstating PERC's scope of negotiations determinations. Chapter 78 benefits were not negotiable, and if this court finds that they were negotiable, that it remanded for arbitration between the parties.
Thank you. Thank you to all parties for the very helpful arguments.